I have to apologise for being a bit vague. I am today. We're in a really busy period now. Like the rains have brought a whole lot of activity in the forest here, and it basically means that the shelter has been running kind of overtime at the moment. So I had a late call last night, so I'm running on 4 hours sleep. I pretty much define myself as working at the Hepburn Wildlife Shelter now. I don't really have much time for anything else. The animation and illustration stuff is a little bit in the past, and little dribs and drabs perhaps that happen when I'm lucky. I guess I should apologise to begin with in terms of endangered species and the title of this talk. I'm not going to go into great detail about all that stuff, because the IUCN have their own definitions, and state bureaucracies and federal bureaucracies go into that in a big way. And the thing I really want to focus on is the nature of the issue. So it's really defined as something that's in danger of becoming extinct. And in the era of climate change, we're pretty much asking who isn't in danger of becoming extinct. So really what I want to raise today are some concepts about what are some of the causes of the endangerment of species, and really looking at why is endangered species and calling things endangered important in the big picture. Because really I want to get through the idea that there's an interdependence that goes on out there, and an individual species isn't really in itself the thing that we should be most worried about. Feel free to interject with statistics or anything else you may have gathered in your own reading. These are the main reasons that I could think of which were causing threatening processes, which means that putting pressure on species, which leads to the endangerment and vulnerability. Predation, of course, is a big one, especially with changing environments. Loss of food source, and that can be changing habitat, or it can be changing environment. Disasters such as bushfires, which we see from a couple of years ago here. Isolation of populations, a really good example of the wombats around here. They're pretty much cut off from the rest of the wombat population in Victoria. So the next westerly group of wombats is down on the south coast in South Australia, or right on the border. And our wombats here are pretty much isolated from those that occur in Gippsland and up the east coast. So there are gene pool issues, really, that are going on there. And with development that builds up, of course, there's more pressure, more boundaries effects occurring in those populations. Disease is a big one. There's increasing evidence of diseases moving south, coming into this area. We're getting rat lung disease coming into our birds down here, which was really only occurring in Queensland before, but now we're getting it in Victoria. It's a worm that buries into the lungs and then gets into the spinal fluids and causes all sorts of damage. Now that's just the name of one of them. It's just a whole range. Climate change, I mentioned. I think we're all pretty much aware of what's happening there. We don't really know the impact of that. We don't understand the processes well enough to really be able to predict that well enough. Habitat loss, and sometimes it's just alteration. It doesn't take much to alter an ecosystem sufficiently to put threats on, especially the more vulnerable, the more specialist species. Disturbance, and that can just be from recreational activities, people being around, other animals being about, pets, new introduced species, natural movement of species across the landscape. Interbreeding, and that's related, of course, to the isolation of populations. But there's races which are forming all over the place in their local populations. They form a climb up the east coast in many cases, like the brush-tailed possums. You can have breeding from the Queensland possums and the New South Wales possums, but the Queensland possums can't actually breed Victorian possums anymore. So it's an extension. It's not really a really clear divide between one species and the next. There's usually some sort of grey area, some spectrum that occurs. And the interbreeding is not only from isolated populations and a lack of gene pool, but it also means that we're breeding out some of the less common of the races. So the Victorian emus that used to occur in this area, you virtually never see them anymore. And we had the West Australian emus, which have been brought over for the commercial culling. It's commercial meat industry. And it collapsed, so they let them all out. And now they're the ones you generally see roaming about. Unless you see one up on Bald Hill, and that's our emu, and he's just got out the last couple of days. So let us know if you see an emu walking around on Bald Hill. So the ones that are occurring here are being interbred with the West Australian race, and therefore they're losing the specialist kind of genetic material they might have built up in this region. End of their evolutionary potential, I guess that's just... some species are so specialised that they're getting to the end of where they could have got to, given all the conditions that got them to where they are. So they may have naturally died out, or they may have naturally evolved into something else.
Can you
have an example
of that?
Well, I'd say in this region, you'd be looking at the bobucks, the mountain brush-tailed possums. We're finding that there's a few little populations which are dotted around on the edge of some of the river lines that are running through the area. But most of them, because of the drying of the whole region, most of those populations are now either interbreeding and dying off from genetic diseases, or they're dying of stress. So the bobucks are now getting pushed further and further into the West Country. So the healthy populations probably stop at Blackwood, and there's not really many good healthy populations. Or maybe Trentham still has a few, but there's a population of wheat sheep which they've pretty much died out in the last 10 years. So I would say that although that is a cause from climate change, they have reached the... I mean, there is a general drying of the continent anyway, so it's an evolutionary pathway that they probably got to. So in a regional sense, they are dying back from their local area. It's quite hard to identify one which you'd say was going to die out anyway. The landscape's so changed now, and the research isn't really clear. It's hard to know whether there is a natural kind of coming to the end of their time. Amongst the Australian population. Can anyone think of one that would be right on the edge of its traditions? I'll have to think about that. If I can come up with a better one, I'll talk to you about it. And the alteration in community dynamics, and that could just be more of one particular species moving into the area, particularly good breeding season, changes in flora or fauna within that region. So it just changes the dynamic that they live amongst. And on a year like this year, when we've got a lot more water in the ground, that will change that dynamic. So we may find that some of those species which are feeling more under threat actually don't make it. And some of the ones in the streams that have been surviving in the little billabongs or in the wet soil, they may be flushed out of the system, so we may actually lose them in this local region. It may take decades for them to creep back up the streamlines. And the reason, well, depends on what happens in future years as to whether that's going to be a permanent condition or not, but it's just the natural movement and flow of community change. Now, there's a couple of key concepts I just want to get through before I move into more of this. I think one of the biggest problems that we face is the frog in hot water principle. Now, it's a horrible analogy, but basically it's that if a frog was put into warm water, or put into water on a stove and then warmed up until it boiled, it wouldn't actually leap out of the water. If you put it into hot water, it will jump out straight away. So what we're seeing is this gradual change. Human lifetimes are longer than most species, but in the evolutionary terms, it's such a short period of time that, and our ability to adapt to things, we can see it in all the ways that we live as humans. This is we have an incredible ability to adapt, so we don't notice the changes that are going on around us, and this allows us to accept those small little changes that are happening. And endangered species are a classic example of what's going on, because They start out as common, they call them common, like a common wombat, and you know, a few years' time, then there's just some threatening processes going on, but it's not until they tip the balance in terms of statistics or someone actually does some research, which doesn't get done very often, that we realise that there's something going on. And Corellas are a really good example. We still get them down here quite regularly. They migrate up to New South Wales. They generally breed along the water lines, Murray River and further north, and then they come back down. But they now are worried that they may be senescing. So that we could have 70-year-old Corellas, which are no longer breeding, but they come down every year. We still think the numbers are good. But when those guys die off, then there won't be any new crop, any new Corellas coming forward. So, I mean, there will be a small number that are managing to find hollows, but it could be the end of that species in very short terms. So, we don't react quickly enough to what we see, and we're far too accepting of it. The airplane ecology is that there's also this acceptance, and you might hear it more now, it's environmental triage. It's a term they use to say that there are some animals which we just have to accept are going to die off, and you know, we'll try and do the best that we can for the ones that we can save. And what really the analogy there is that if we just keep knocking rivets out of aeroplanes, they'll be fine for a while, you know, they'll keep flying, but one day that wing's going to fall off and then you have a catastrophic drop. In ecological circles, the threshold and keystone species is what they relate to this problem. Now, there are keystone species which basically support the whole ecosystem. These ideas are less influential these days, so I don't hold too much to there's a particular species that's going to do it, that's going to hold the whole system together. But I think there is a tendency for that to happen. So there are some very strong animals, very strong important elements in the forest, or in the forest and across the landscape, which if we lose those, we can lose the whole lot. And fungi is probably one of the big ones around here. Tragedy of the commons is often something you hear in economic circles. It's basically that there are some resources, commodities, however you want to perceive them, which are considered to be everybody's domain, and wildlife are one of those. Now, wildlife and the natural resources that surround them. And what tends to happen, this is a very powerful concept in economics, but if you apply it to ecology, the tragedy is that no one actually takes responsibility because it's everybody's responsibility. So it gets overused by everybody. And the theory goes that the market will decide. So eventually when there's fewer and fewer amounts of these creatures, and they often use this in whaling circles, that when the numbers are so low that they become rare, their value is so great that it no longer becomes worthwhile either for them to hunt them or their... you know, that they can't actually run an industry on. But the tragedy is that what we see now with the threats that they're facing, that no one's actually taking responsibility. Now, ecology is seen in various ways right across the ecology industry. So, I guess I want to give you a picture that I'm coming from a systems approach, so I don't tend to go into the species stuff very much. Most of the work has been done on population ecology, and that's looking at particular populations of particular species and measuring them, looking at their dynamics, and that feeds a lot of our knowledge about the world. And it doesn't include all the interactions that occur around those species. So community ecology is where you look at the food web, so the animals that occur around that and the plants that they may feed on. So it broadens it out a bit, so they have a better understanding of that. But more recently, landscape ecology is now coming into it, and that brings in all the flows that run through an ecosystem and run in and run out. So I think it's a much healthier way to look at an ecosystem is to look at it as a whole system. Like it is an organism in itself. And there's also debate about how important a particular species is and a particular kind of genetic material. And my bias, I guess, is on ecosystem function. So if that function is being met by some other source, then that ecosystem is still healthy. So a good example of that, I would say, would be things like some of the weeds we get around here, like blackberry. It forms a really important habitat for a lot of small birds, a lot of small mammals that might live away from the foxes in those briar patches. So the function of finding some sort of shelter for those animals is still being met. It's a complicated one because there are all sorts of other issues around that. But some of the work that has been done is to look at, like the Victorian Mallee is related very closely to the tundra in North America, so that we can see similar kind of multi-stemmed plants growing out of that ground, very dry in terms of accessible water, and extremes in their climate. And the function of those two things, we can learn a lot about researching the tundra. We can learn a lot about how the Mallee works in Victoria. So that looking at function is actually quite informative for the science, as well as thinking about what is actually of value to us as a, you know, as part of the environment. The key thing for me is interdependence. So we should be looking at what are the things around any particular issue which are dependent on those things. So a good example of that would be that there's no point in looking at the occurrence of, say, lorikeets in this area if we're not actually looking at what are the things that lorikeet needs to be kept here. So if, for example, someone wanted to put up a nest box and they were particularly keen on seeing the musk lorikeets around the place, then they'd have to be considering the food sources that go with that nest box so that the animal is actually going to stay in the area and be able to feed. It will have to find mating pairs in the area, and that requires conditions so that they can hear each other and flock together. Some of the black cockatoos, they really don't like to be able to hear other cockatoos nesting nearby, so they like to have a bit of distance. So we were having problems here when they were leaving one habitat tree in the middle of a big clear fell food, because one cockatoo pair would sit in that tree and they'd be heard all around the edge of that coop. So the other black cockatoos would have to move further out to form their nests. So we need to be looking at all those interdependencies between the habitat and the creature, and the other creatures within that. The other thing just to keep in mind is that we hear about survival of the fittest and the force, the great force in evolution and adaptation from competition, but one of the key things that has made species survive is cooperation. And I would argue that cooperation is actually a more powerful force than competition. Now, I would like to look specifically at habitat and the loss of habitat. So, Laszlo is a guy that's done lots of work on basic survival, and he's got a hierarchy of needs, and I don't remember all that stuff very well, but I do remember that there are five key things, and I think I've got the right five, that an animal needs in order to survive. And basically that's food, shelter, water, sex, and their social contact. So those are the things that they make their primary decisions about. And that's very useful when we're looking at habitat, but there are so many other things that we really need to be considering when we're looking at it. And this has a real implication for us. Like, we see this practically every day, because the reasons that animals come into care, so that they need to be rescued, often relate to a lot of these things. So seasonal variations are a big one, like koalas particularly coming down for water in summer, and they get into trouble because they go into people's backyards. So we get a lot of koalas in dry summers, and last summer was pretty good for us.
But they go down looking for water, and from 10 years of drought, the phenols in the leaves around here have been really high. Like the leaves are actually quite dry, so they've got a really big build-up of the oils and the phenols that are in eucalyptus trees in particular, and they're really toxic. So the koalas need a lot more water to flush their systems. So those variations, so that's actually a long-term cycle, or much more, it's medium-term really, because of that drying process. Possum Hollows, that affects you. You're putting up a possum box, so you've got one in your roof, and you decide you're going to seal up your roof, and you're going to put the possum in a box. It will probably need three boxes, because depending on where the sun's coming from, like in winter they like to face to the north, in summer they'd much rather be on the southeast side of the tree. So they have multiple burrows, and they will have hollows, and they will share those hollows with others. So there's an interaction that goes within the population, and there's also an interaction that goes with other species. So at times of the year there will be other species that will use those hollows that they're not using. And wombat burrows are another one. They will move into an area like Lionville. They're not there at the moment, are they? They move back in summer, I think, around you. Are you seeing them around you? Okay. Yeah, okay. When we did our research there last spring, we found that most of them had moved out then, so I was expecting to come back in summer, but maybe they leave in spring. That might be possible. There's a lot of movement on the road at the moment, so they might actually be moving this time of year. Okay, now synergism, and that's where they work together. So there's a kind of a positive effect of having others in their area. So a wombat usually digs one primary burrow in its life. So when we're thinking about release of these animals, we need to make sure that we're releasing them into areas where they're going to be for the rest of their lives, pretty much. Because they put a lot of energy into that burrow, that primary burrow. And they may build shorter ones, up to 2 metres long, for temporary habitation, but the really long ones that they tend to make generational burrows and they raise their young in, there's very few of those that they can build in a lifetime. They are right on the edge of their range. They're the largest burrowing vegetarian mammal. So the food they get out of our grasses, the nutrients, is only just enough for them to do a certain amount of activity. And the synergism works there for them. If they live around the other wombats, there's other wombats that are digging burrows, and they share burrows. So it means that there is much more opportunity for them to find the shelter that they need. And of course, things like kangaroos like to work with other animals like cockatoos, because the cockatoos usually have a sentinel that will let them know if something's approaching, and they'll react to those bird sounds. So there's a whole lot of interaction which occurs on a positive sense, and this is where I think cooperation is so important for those evolutionary processes. Long-term changes and cycles, talking about the lorikeets, we're now seeing a lot more of the rainbow lorikeets moving up here. And some of that, we think, is to do with the drying of this area. Like they're used to more lowland kind of country. And it's not so cold around here anymore, so they're moving up into the areas around Melbourne, into the higher country. I don't really know the main reasons for these things, but we do see these big changes. We know that galahs are moving down from the drier areas down into here as well. And that may actually be, it may be water related, but it may actually be an evolutionary process. They've actually been moving gradually over many years. Quality of habitat. That's about the koalas, but the leaves that they're eating in the dry times are not good for them. So they tend to move down into the gullies, or they tend to find better trees which are more suited to them. We find that we go out, when we've got koalas in care, we have to go out pretty much every day to pick leaves. Sometimes every 2 days we can stretch it to. And depends on where the koala comes from, we have to pick leaves from very different places. So the last lot of koalas we had to pick from Yandoi Bay. They really like those leaves out there, although they came from the Riddles Creek area. But for some reason they particularly like the taste of those leaves, so we had to go up there for those, and then we had another one in care at the same time which we had to go down to Musvale to pick leaves for. So they have very particular tastes, and the quality of the habitat that they grow up in is usually what they get familiar with. So when we find these dry years, it gets more and more difficult for us to find the right kind of leaves for them. Quantity of habitat, and again that's the contiguity, which is how connected the landscape is, and obviously that's very important for those creatures that they tend to have a fairly tight territorial area. So that when people think of wildlife corridors, they think that they go from one place, they walk down the corridor and they go to the next place. But in actual fact, they have to live along the corridor, so that as each generation grows and breeds, it moves down the corridor. So the idea is to have a corridor wide enough and healthy enough so you can actually have a passage of growth and full life cycles within that area, rather than them just moving from one to the next. I mean, that's fine for kangaroos. They tend to, you know, they can move large distances. But it doesn't work for a lot of the smaller creatures. Some of the smaller native rats won't even cross tracks, because owls will hunt along tracks. So they won't cross any open area. So any new track that goes in means that that particular population of rats is probably going to be contained within that small area. Adaptation. This is one of the really difficult things, and this is where I think that we need to be very careful about how we define natural habitat. Possums are a great example. They've done really well in the city. They live in people's roofs, they live in all the introduced plants, sheds, anything they can find, and their population is booming down there. Up here we very rarely see possums coming in, and that's mainly because the foxes have basically preyed them out. So there are a few that live down, live in the trees around here, but their numbers are much lower than they should be, naturally, before the foxes come. So although they can adapt to living in our spaces, their ability to adapt depends greatly on what the stress or the influence is. And trying to take account of that makes habitat planning extremely difficult. Then there's microhabitats. So when we talk about hollows, I don't know whether you've also been coming to the other talks that have been in this season of lectures, but Gail, that was your one, wasn't it? Hollows? Yeah. But when we talk about hollows, we have to be aware that it's not just something to live, and that may change over the years, over the seasons as well, so different animals move in at different times. But hollows also form little micro habitats of their own. So they fill up with water, they become water sources for a lot of the arboreal animals that live in the trees. Some of the frogs will actually breed in those hollows. Insects will use them as weak points, because it softens the wood around those points, and they will use them as access into the wood. So it's really important that we... think about habitat in a much broader sense, so that we don't get locked into thinking that a particular habitat element, like a hollow, has one role to play. And you know, fungi are another one, that they have a great decomposition role, but they also provide food, they provide all sorts of soil activity, which allows other animals to survive in the forest. And animal movement. This is a really difficult one, because a good example here is the culling permits which are issued for kangaroos here. There's 40 culling permits currently in operation, which means that 1,400 kangaroos just within our shire are allowed to be shot this year. And what we're what we're suspecting, and we can't get hold of a lot of the detail of this data because it's under commercial interest, we're suspecting that we're looking at similar mobs moving through several properties, and those several properties each have an opportunity to shoot out 20% of the population that occurs on their property. So the same mob could actually be completely wiped out within a season if it is the same mob getting permits for each property. And no one's actually doing that research. People order those permits over the net, and they just say, we have this number of kangaroos here, and they have given them permits for 20% of those. So animal movement is a really big issue in terms of habitat. You'll find when you see kangaroos, usually it's when they're on the big grassy plains, usually around dusk. They gather together, they form their big family mobs, and that's where they have a lot of their social time, and they have often good food source out there. And then they break up into small family groups, around 6 to 10. Sometimes the females will go off by themselves. Sometimes the males will form bachelor mobs. And they disperse throughout the forest. So you'll often hear people who have been in the area for a long time saying they've never seen so many kangaroos, because kangaroos now only have one particular paddock that they like to gather on, rather than really understanding the actual movement of these animals and how they're surviving across the landscape. These are the kind of issues that we try and confront when we're doing our rehabilitation, because we need to make sure that the animals we have in care are actually being trained to survive in the wild. So at the shelter, we have to try and give them the social concept that they need. We need to give them familiar kind of housing that they might be expecting, and that might change as the seasons change too. So in winter we might be providing a different kind of nest box to what they might have in summer. For bats, we have to make sure we're allowing for their hibernation time in this area, because most of the other bats would be hibernating around about now. For koalas, we had a koala last year which was found in someone's backyard. A dog attacked it, and she was, all her intercostal muscles were all torn. There's a single puncture wound from a dog, when it shakes the animal, actually just it tears all the flesh underneath the skin, so it looks like two small holes, and people may think that animal's going to be fine. And we did at the time as well. We thought, oh well, we better catch her just to be sure. But when the vet opened her up, you can see a flailing rib. So when the vet opened her up, you can see all the flesh had been all torn up by the teeth as it shook the koala. But anyway, the result of that was she was in care for about 6 months. And we needed to put her back out, but we couldn't take her back to this property, of course, because there was a big Malamute dog in the backyard. So we tried to find the nearest bit of contiguous natural bushland around, and it took us about 3 days to find it. We had to do map searches, we had to do ground searches. We crossed two electric fences. We had to go on one side of a creek, and eventually ran into Black Creek before we could actually get to trees. So we had to come all the way back again and cross another three set of fences before we found a tree that was linked down a creek line that we could put her in. And these kind of interferences in their habitat are, I mean, they deal with them every day, but we kind of see some of the problems that these animals face just trying to cross the landscape. This is why I guess I'm speaking from my perspective here, I'm hopefully it's actually making some sense. Now, habitat disturbance can be a whole range of things. I'll just go over this very quickly. The presence of strangers, and that can be just hearing people's voices around the place, can really upset them. Like, you'll see kangaroos, they'll stand up, they'll stop eating whenever they hear human voices, or even sometimes just cars passing if they're in a quiet area normally. Variations in the populations and communities, and that can be the introduction of a whole range of new animals, or it could be just changes in that particular population, like a flock of corellas may move in, or a flock of cockatoos, or you'll see battles this time of year between the choughs and the magpies and the currawongs. They're all fighting. In our backyard at the moment, there is this big three-way war going on about who's going to take the territory. Noise is a big one. Most Australian animals, this is why we're able to have so many in shelter. We have around about 80 at a time, and we're able to manage it because most of them don't make any noise. And you bring one human child into your house and you notice the difference, you know. So people are often ask us whether we've thought about having kids, but it's often the noise factor for us. We've definitely decided to stick with Australian animals. And obviously noise is one of their primary messages for alert. So it puts them on guard, it means they're eating less, and it changes their whole ability to meet the other needs that they have. Smells are really important, and you'll notice if you know a wombat in their area and you put anything new into that environment, then that wombat will poo on it that night, and you'll just see a little pile of cubes. Because it smells different, they're really conscious of any changes to their environment. Smells can also include, well, we really notice when people come in who are wearing perfume that the animals react quite differently to them. So they're very alert to any changes in those kind of smells. And they often recognise each other by their smells as well. So we may have 30 kangaroos in at any one time, but if a new one comes in, they know immediately that there's a new one in. Because even though I suppose they might be able to recognise each other, we tend to be able to recognise the little ones that we raise, but I start to get a bit hazy when it gets over 15. So they find smell obviously a really crucial way of identifying what's in their environment. Light's the big one. Changes the way moths move. I don't know whether you heard, it must have been 15 years ago now, the bogon moths in Sydney, in the mountains of outside Sydney, all flew into Sydney because the conditions were just right and there was a light bounce off the clouds. I can't remember what quite the conditions were, but all the bogons, the male moths were the ones that moved, and the females were sitting up there in the forest, and all the males flew into the city. And they had a really bad breeding season that year because they two didn't eat. And that was purely because they were drawn by the light. And that affects bats, of course. You'll find that if you ever get a bat in your house, the best thing to do is just turn on your outside lights, because they'll go chasing moths and the other things they catch. So they'll actually fly out of the house to the light source. They're very sensitive to tactile things, so the sensory stuff like any vibrations, cars moving on the roads, winds, obviously, temperature changes. All those things are also part of their habitat. So when coots are clear felled or trees are removed from their local area, it changes where their nesting sites are. We find we get a lot of tawny frogmouths coming in because they traditionally build a very, it's a shoddy little nest. It's just a bunch of sticks basically in a little platform. And they're used to building them in quite well protected forest areas. But now there are so few of those. And they often hunt on the edge of fairly open plains because it's easier for them. Those trees are much more exposed to wind, so we find that a lot of the chicks get blown out these days, so a lot of the chicks come into care. Alterations to the structure of the habitat. So weed removal can have a big impact. And again, the wombat thing, anything you put in their way, they will really notice the difference. Changes to the health of the environment, so that's obviously climate change. Stress can be a big factor. We find that the occurrence of mange in wombats in particular went up quite astronomically while they were doing the last few years of logging. And it's, we think it's improved a little bit more since, but things have calmed down a little bit. But when there's disturbance going on, that level of stress changes their whole ability to fight off disease and other impacts on their ability to survive. Variation in ecosystem flows. So ecosystem flows can be a whole range of things. It's not just the way nutrients move in and out of an environment. So there's all sorts of cycles that go on, carbon cycles and nitrogen cycles and phosphorus cycles. So I won't go into too much detail there, but they can change quite rapidly. So on a year like this, when there's a lot more nutrients being flushed through the system, it can have quite significant changes. And their ability to adapt, it'll be quite interesting to see actually what happens this year, because their ability to adapt is affected by all the other things that have been going on over the last 10 years as well. So for some it'll be a benefit, for others it'll be a bit of a problem. I think the echidnas will do well this year, because a lot of the ants have risen to the surface to get to their holes have all filled. So they could have a really good breeding season this year. But probably not so good for wombats, because a lot of their burrows have been flooded. So there's a lot more activity out there once they're moving around. Interestingly enough, actually, this is Gail and me. This is our shelter. I just wanted to give you a little bit more of a an insight into what we see, so you see why I'm talking about this stuff the way I am. Our shelter's up on Bald Hill, just outside Dalesford. It's a really quite a good release site, because we're on quite a steep slope, so the animals tend to move down or up the slope. So we don't find that we're getting too overfilled. Although we have introduced wombats back to the hill, they got removed during the mining period, and a lot of their burrows got flooded this year. So we've got four really big ones, full size, tipping over anything that they can possibly tip over, and three little ones who are supposed to be finding their own way in the forest, who are now too afraid to go out there because there's too much activity. So it hasn't worked out very well for us this year on the wombat front. Yes. Basically what we do, would there now be the time to have a cup of tea or something, or shall I just keep going quickly? I'll run through a bit of background on the shelter. Would you like to hear a bit of the background on the shelter? Linda also is a wildlife carer. So there's not many in our area. We're probably the largest shelter in this region. We've just set ourselves up as a charity, because there's no government support for wildlife care, so we all have to try and raise money wherever we can. And the main focus for us is the direct short-term care of wildlife for its release. So the idea is to get them back out there, rehabilitate them. We also do a lot of rescues, and so that means not all of them come into care, obviously. Some of them can just be released, and some are just needed a bit of advice about what you can do. A lot of people who find bats in their houses, it's a very simple process of helping them remove those bats. We work with a network of other wildlife carers, vets, organisations that do rescue work, the DSE, police councils. There's a whole range of people that we connect with who need assistance with wildlife issues. We provide sanctuary and shelter for animals that require care, so we also need a lot of facilities at our setup to contain them so they can recover or be raised. Because we work with orphans a lot, probably close on half the animals we do with the orphans, I think, as well as the injured ones and the sick ones. We do training and workshops or help coordinate those things. We produce materials to educate people more about living with wildlife. Is something that's being produced at the moment by the Koala. What's the Tanya's group? Koala Connect, is it? Koala Connect. We're just producing something at the moment, a little bit of information about living with wildlife. Providing emergency advice and care. Try and support as many other people as we can who are doing similar things. We support and engage research into wildlife as much as we can. We don't have much time for that these days. We are running a mange treatment program, which basically is going to start with a wombat survey, so we're going to look at all of where the wombat populations were here, but we just haven't managed to get the time to run the volunteer work that that requires. So most of that work is now actually being done by the wildlife, the wombat forest care people, the kind of research work that's been done around here. And then we have to maintain the property, of course, for the animals. We moved up from St Kilda back 8 years ago, no, 9 years ago, and we brought a whole bunch of city animals with us initially. So we were doing small stuff like tawny frog mallards, possums, ring-tailed possums, and then a wombat turned up. So we had to decide, were we going to hand him on to another shelter who was going to raise him and release him, or were we going to move out and do what we had always planned and get out of the city? So we made the choice and moved out up here. And I'll just give you a quick background on what our rehab is. The department defines it as caring for sick, orphaned or injured wildlife, looking after their veterinary assessment and treatment, and we do the nursing side of things, and the whole goal is to get them back out there. We're not allowed to run a sanctuary as such, so we can't kind of put barriers up around the property and care for animals. They have to be in a condition to be able to live in their environment. Now, we define that they don't do a lot of work with the government, basically. They set some guidelines and then that's it. So we define what they mean to mean that an animal that is able to survive in this environment without being unduly likely to be preyed upon is sufficient. It doesn't have to be perfect, because we get many animals coming into care from the wild which aren't perfect. They've got old scars, they've got injuries, they're missing limbs even sometimes. And they're surviving, so we consider that in that sort of condition, if they're able to do that, and we do quite a long rehab program to make sure that they can survive, then we get them back out there. The DSE again, so that our purpose is an animal welfare issue. It's not about conservation, so we're not really doing anything to do with habitat management or endangered species. In fact, very rarely do we have any contact with endangered species. There's usually other programs in place, well, theoretically, there's other programs in place which care for endangered species. Having said that, we did raise a fantastic gar last year, which was very successfully released around us, because luckily we live right on into Fasigal country. I'll show you a picture of that in a minute, what a Fasigal is, if you're not sure. But we do benefit conservation through the research work we do, through our understanding of eco-processes, through actual contact with animals so we understand their behaviours a lot more, and through the network that we have with the community as well. Why we go about it? For us, it's an ethical thing. For us, we see the need and we try and fill it. And we know we have a lot of community support for it. We don't expect the whole community to be doing this kind of work. So it's a question of trying to be part of a community that does live with wildlife. Of course, selfishly, it's a chance to be close to them, and we've always wanted to be. So we really enjoy the contact we have with them. It's not always pretty, because there's some pretty awful things that happen to them out there. We had a girl come in late last night, she's a young Joey, she was out peeled from her mum. Her mum just got in front of the car, but the car ran over, just clipped the edge of this girl's foot and completely peeled the skin off the foot. So it was just horrible. You can see the bone exposed and it's a mess. So she's got getting better in care today, so hopefully we'll be able to save her. The starfish analogy is the one I like, and that's, you may have seen this, I'm just keeping putting on the bottom of their emails. There's a child that's walking along the beach, and he or she is picking up a starfish, which is, there are millions all washed up on the beach after a storm. And he's picking one up at a time, putting it into the water, and someone comes along and says, you know, you're not making any difference, because there's millions of them here, you know, it's pointless. And the child's response to that is that, it makes a difference to that one. And that's the thing that motivates us, that we focus on the individual and we are really trying to do what we think is the ethical thing. And again, it's a welfare issue for us, not necessarily a conservation one at all. And education side of things is a secondary issue for us. I mean, it's great for me to have an opportunity to talk to people, but in many cases we just don't have it because we're stuck in the forest and we hardly ever leave the house. But the four kind of key things that drive me are the compassion for wildlife, encouraging consideration for them, so that even if we don't necessarily give them all the rights that they may wish for, we at least consider them. So we think about what their needs are before we actually make blanket decisions about them. We go about the care of them and creating a sense of connection with the natural environment that we live in. this is the legal stuff, I'll just whiz through that. Basically, you need to have a license to be a wildlife carer or to be a foster carer, and that's controlled by the department. And it's illegal to have contact with wildlife without that sort of license or some sort of permit. As becoming a carer, you need to be a foster carer first, and then you can, after a year, you can actually become your own shelter. And the theory there is that you're apprenticed to a shelter and you learn the skills that you need from that shelter, because there's no other formal training. We do advise people to do other training, because there's a whole range of creatures out there and they all have different needs, and different wounds are required different kind of treatment. So it's very different to raise an animal as it is to care for one that's been injured, because you're dealing with a wild, stressed out animal when it comes in as an adult. But as a young one, if you can form that maternal bond, then it's a very different experience, and it's, you know, quite lovely and it's all very cute. But then you have to rehabilitate it to understand that it is going out into the wild. So there's very different bodies of knowledge out there that you need to develop. There's all sorts of institutional issues, which I won't go into. Funding being one of the big ones. Now, I'll just whiz through some of these incidents. And most of these are some sort of habitat disturbance. Road crime is a big one, of course. The landscape's been completely cut up by tracks and roads. And not only do those roads form barriers in themselves for some of the smaller creatures, but of course, cars, trail bikes, pretty much cars and trail bikes and trucks, those kind of things do direct damage. Bushfires are obviously a big one. If anyone was in this area a couple of years ago, and it's an increasing problem because of now the demand for burn, what is it, 20% of the state every year? So, you know, that's going to have massive implications on wildlife and their habitats. Fences, one of the big issues at the moment for us. We're getting huge numbers of fence hangers, and that's only because they're moving across the landscape. The female roos are carrying a heavy joey now, because the joeys are just about at emergent size, and they're not making the fences that they used to make, so they're catching their feet all the time. And what happens with the way fences are built is you get the two wires running across the top, and the foot goes under the top one, and because it's a long foot, it catches the one underneath and it just forms a twist. So we have direct damage to the skin here, but there's also a constriction which occurs. So if the animal's in the fence for more than a few minutes, there's blood flow issues, and that can lead to all sorts of complications on the wound. So we often lose flesh later on, even weeks down the track, where the blood flow has been interrupted. So they can be very significant wounds. So say nothing of the damage to ligaments and joints from the, being hung from a fence for long periods. Dog attack is a really big issue with koalas, particularly in summer. But some of the possums, we had a possum this morning, it's coming from a cat attack. Cats usually get birds, possums, those kind of the smaller animals, of course. Shootings is legal and illegal shootings. We get quite a lot of those. We had a kangaroo come in this week sometime, and she was peppered with pellets from gunshots, shotguns, sorry. And obviously, that would be an illegal shooting, because you're not allowed to shoot animals with shotguns unless it's point blank range and it's just for euthanasia. But people who have permits to shoot also have quite tight restrictions, so it's really important that the community is vigilant about those kind of things, because there's a lot of people that just want to go shooting on the weekend and they get themselves a permit and they bring up their mates from the suburbs or some of the outer towns of Melbourne. And they just bring them up, and they've got no skills about how to shoot. They don't really know where to shoot an animal, so it's humane, and they don't even have the right kind of calibre of rifle sometimes. Mange is a big issue for our wombats in this area. Most isolated populations of wombats suffer mange. It occurs right up the east coast, and it's usually the isolated population. So we have a suspicion that it's a stress-related issue, which is why we're trying to do the research. And We've got someone looking into iron levels in the blood to see whether that makes a difference, because two wombats raised together, one will get maimed, one won't. So there's obviously some other genetic or metabolic issues that are involved. It's quite a mystery. But it is treatable. It's just a little mite. It's a tiny little insect. Well, it's an arthropod, but it burrows under the skin, and it's the same thing that humans get. They get scabies, and dogs get mange, but it doesn't affect them in quite the same way. These guys have a hyper-allergic reaction to it, so their skin thickens, becomes hard crust, and then splits. And if you can catch it before it splits, then it's perfectly treatable. But when the splits occur, it actually breaks down through the skin layer into the flesh, and infection gets in, and then their internal organs are seriously compromised. So we have to catch it quite early. Habitat disturbance. Now, this little bat was in a log, someone's firewood, and they just shifted the firewood and it got crushed. So I guess this goes back to that adaptation, that they've moved into places where humans are, and our activity, even within our own little zones, can have a huge impact on wildlife. Positive and negative, of course. We can do lots of things which encourage wildlife and do good things for them. A lot of orphans come in. We probably do 20 or 30 orphans a year for kangaroos and wallabies. And then bird season and possum season is about to start in spring. So this is round about the time for kangaroos and wallabies. We've currently got 8 still in pouches and another... I please count. Another 13 that's still on bottles at the moment. Poison and disease also obviously affect some of the poisons are direct, so people are trying to poison them, like often the parrots are poisoned by landholders because they eat their seeds when they're cropping. But they could be incidental as well, like people put rat baits up on their roof to get rid of rats and possums eat them, or the rats come out and owls eat the rats. So there's secondary poisonings. And we had a big spate of cockatoos last year that were taking herbicides in, which is obviously weed control, so it's nothing to do with kind of problem animals, and they've been poisoned by those. Mine shafts are a big problem in this area too. We do not a huge number, because it's really quite hard to find them when they're down there. You often find their bodies down the bottom because they've been down there for more than 3 days and they die first. But we do the odd one, and it's usually people walking their dogs that find them. You know, the dogs will notice them, or smell them basically. And we can get Joe. This one was, he was a big guy. He was about 60 kilos, this guy. He's huge. Sorry about the photo. But he's down the bottom of the, it's about 4 metres down, my chart. They get trapped. This is a cattle grid. They get stuck in people's sheds. Bats obviously get caught in people's houses. Sometimes they get sealed up in their roofs when they seal up holes and they haven't got them all out. A lot of chimneys this year. We had rosellas falling in the chimneys for some reason. Trail bikes, they basically they cause a disturbance, and when the animal's running, particularly kangaroos, this is, but it also occurs with birds. They have a panic response, and it's just flight. They want to get out of there. They misjudge the fences, or they don't see them at all, and that's when they get caught. This little guy, his leg was broken when his mum was caught the fence. She broke her neck actually. He's right. Kookaburras and windows, I don't imagine many of you have this experience. Particularly this time of year, the young males are really keen to bang on your windows, any sort of reflection of their own selves. Like, they're basically trying to scare off all the other kookaburras in the area. So, and this guy, he got caught in a mesh screen which was put over a window, and it took a chunk out of his bill. So, we actually had to put fiberglass over that pill because it wouldn't repair otherwise. It doesn't create that. Yeah. Usually the green ones, isn't it? The young ones. Yeah. You can leave them for a few minutes, and if they're not recovering, then they really should come into care. It is a head injury, so it can be quite expensive. We've had them sitting in a cage for 3 weeks with their heads upside down, and then recovering. Yeah, so it depends. It's really hard to know with brain injuries what the damage actually is. So sometimes they'll survive for about 10 days, and then when the blood flow starts again, they'll often get little clots moving, and they have strokes, and they die. So if they can survive 10 days, then they usually do good. But they really should come into care. It's just best to make sure that they're kept warm, because they could be in shock, and kept protected, yeah. And lack of minimal stimulation is a key one there. And that, again, that's noise. So if any animals ever pick up, it's really important to keep them in the quiet. We also do other animals. So the occasional lambs, got a goat in at the moment. There's usually cats around Easter time when people have had their Christmas present, and the kids are back at school, and they bring them up here for the holidays, and then they let them go in the forest. Dogs occasionally do the same thing. People on holidays. This is for people who are dealing with wildlife. There's lots of issues about personal safety, and it's all about looking after yourself first, really. This is our rescue gear, some immediate care issues. This information can be found on our website. We do at least 400 animals come into the shelter. There's about 700 wildlife rescue calls a year, so it's about 2 a day on average. The bushfire season last 2 years ago bumped that figure right out, so we don't include that, but occasionally there's disasters which have an impact, but this is just the everyday incidents that occur. Some of it's really simple to deal with, just some advice. Often it's euthanasia, often the animal just dies, and many times we just never find it again, because they hit an animal, we go out to it and it's got itself up and out into the bush, and it's almost impossible to find it. This little guy, the kangaroos are probably our big one. That's the thing we do mostly out here, which is a bit of a shock to us, having done possums and birds in St Kilda. We weren't really prepared for the big animals, so we've had to learn an awful lot about kangaroos. What would you say is your main animal that comes in?
Sorry?
What's your main animal that comes in?
It's actually, predominantly birds, like possums and
just the season. Yeah, it varies a lot over the season. This guy's from the fire. He can see his feet were burnt. They tend to go in a big loop, so when they're disturbed, the wallabies will go about 50 metres and then come around, or they'll stop actually usually, and then they'll come back. Kangaroos will run about 300 metres or so and then come back in a big loop, so they'll often pick up joeys that have been dropped when they've been scared. If whatever disturbance has moved from the area, but if people are standing there around their joey, or the dog's still there, or the trail box moving through, then obviously they won't. But unfortunately, that means with fire, they'll often come around and they walk back past, around the flames and back onto the hot ground. So they walk onto the red coals and burn their feet. This is a fence hanging worm that's broken down. So. Some of these are pretty nasty, sorry, I'll whiz through them. These are burns, again, this is burns. We had a huge number of roos come through after the last fires. Koalas again, burns are our big one. Kangaroos are usually fences, cars and bushfires. Koalas are usually dogs, cars and bushfires. Wombats, this is a burn, went right down. We had a lot of these come in, burnt right from the shoulders down to the back. Not quite sure how they got those burns, but it was all very common that came through. The orphans that come in, orphans obviously are the other big one. We don't get many young koalas come in, but we get lots of young kangaroos come in. And we find that having large numbers of animals at the shelter, and breeders at the shelter, they help raise each other. So this little one here, she was terrified of everything except when she bonded to this large one. She's got a spinal injury, that girl. And it helps a lot. It settles them right down. So it's a big advantage actually to be a busy shelter. more difficult to do one or two. Wallabies are another one we get. We don't get them so often because they're often, when they're hit by cars, because they scoot along low, they often get a body hit, whereas the kangaroos often get a leg hit from the cars. So the damage to them, often a lot of internal injury, so they often don't survive, and the joeys are often very badly bruised, so we get less of them in. It's just the one type, it's just the swamp wallaby or the black wallaby we get here, and the eastern grey is the only kangaroo we get here too. We always try and raise them in pairs if we can, but they're a nightmare in the house. They just go up everything. Quite difficult to deal with. This is a mob at the moment. Joey's. And they get bottle fed for, well, they're normally fed for about a year and a half in the wild by their mums, which is getting to about this size. Sometimes they'll go a bit longer, it depends on the mum. The bigger mums actually feed them for a bit longer. It depends a bit whether they've got another joe in the pouch, because they can have another one that they're raising on a different type of milk on the other teat they've got, while we're feeding the one that's out of the pouch.
It has to be in the pouch to feed?
No, they have one at heel, which puts its head into the pouch and drinks from one teat, and there's one in the pouch, or can be one in the pouch, which feeds exclusively from the teat. So they have to be on the right teat, but they could just put their heads inside. In care, in practice, it's usually about 2 years before they're weaned and ready for release, because they're a bit backward, because we can't, you know, hop them through the forest and take them out to the best grazing grounds and all that. So we do that with the wombats. We walk them through the forest and show them where they're going to be, and that helps a lot. But the male wombats are particularly sooky, so they're really hard to get rid of them. They come in, the 300 grams is the smallest kangaroo we've raised, which is about the size of a rat, I suppose. They do like the comforts of home. And that's a chicken. Most prefer kangaroos to other chickens. They get access. There's one room in the house which is ours, all the rest of it's animals back there. We keep these alpacas at the house for fox protection for the joeys. So they've got an area around the house. Initially there's an enclosure around the back of the house where they all exercise, and then we allow them out into this large area you see there, which is protected by the alpacas, and then they go outside the fences into the wild. This year, the first year actually, we've had the females staying at home while they've got their own joeys from the wild, so it's quite a treat to see them. We had a documentary crew from Germany last year making a documentary about us.
Have you learned anything about raising joeys by watching the hunters raising?
I guess so, over the years. In fact, I'd say every day we learn something new. There's always a lot more that we pick up. Some mothers are a lot better than others, mind you. Some are pretty hopeless and virtually ignore their joeys, and others are really careful, like, particularly learning the language, because there's the little clucking noise they make, and there's the kind of ratcheting noise that the little one makes when it needs to make contact. And there's subtle changes in that clucking, which means some of it is alarm, I want you to come to me, and some of it is just contact call. So I'm still learning that language. It's very extensive at this stage.
I lived in an Aboriginal community for a few years, and we raised a few joeys.
Okay.
The Mullumbeen Nation.
Yeah. Is that reds?
Yes.
Red kangaroos?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We didn't get any more than
2 hours,
but three.
And three
joeys.
Okay.
One
is that
because
they're
eaten? No. One's got diarrhea or two. Actually, we made one.
Okay.
could be. Yeah.
You know, that doesn't
be honest. Yeah, well, one of the things we have learned is that they all have their own personalities. It's an amazing range of personalities. And of course, there are traits which are the same amongst them all, but they are so different. Like, one animal can come in with the most horrendous wounds and will survive, and another with only minor injuries and not survive. And, you know, there's really nothing to tell the difference other than either their ability to cope with the stress of being in care, or just their tenacity, their ability to fight through those sort of injuries. And I think for us it's an advantage to have all the others around, because it does reduce their stress levels and they get a lot more support, so they don't have those sort of grief problems as much. Although there still are some that really take a long time to settle in. It usually takes 2 to 3 days for a joey to rebond for us. But sometimes I'll take a couple of weeks, and then you know, there's a particular type of joey that you can see from his behaviour that he's going to be one of those really highly strung ones that will be stressy. Yeah. Same with the wombats. There's a section of the house they come and go in and out of. So at the moment we've got seven wombats. Okay. This is when they're really nice, this sort of size. They're just adorable. But they try and get into anything, and bedrooms are the best place to be. We've got steel plates over our doors that prevent them getting access to bedrooms. So we'll get into everything. This girl here, she got run over by a four-wheel drive and it tore her pouch open, and her joey, she wasn't able to hold her joey in. But unfortunately, because of that, we had to raise the joey because we couldn't be guaranteed that she would continue to feed. But we allowed her visiting rights. So that was actually quite a lovely experience, huh? This is Basil, actually, who's, if any of you have been... That's right, yeah. So, his story's been followed in the, what do you call your newsletter? What? Yeah. But he's a really big guy now. Like, he's been away in the forest. He's only come back just in the last couple of weeks because I think his burrow got too soggy. So he's been back at the house causing trouble. This is a young one being. That's not actually his mum, that one there. That's one of the other ones we've raised. And he was terrified. This little joey was terrified. But this one, the bigger one, helped him settle in. And it took a while. And they got to be great fast friends. And this is Onyx, the one we got in care. And she's got her own joey. It's the first time we've had a wombat come back with her own joey. Koalas is another big one. We don't get many of the joeys in for them. They're mainly cars and dogs. Ring-tailed possums, mainly cats, bring those in, or fallen trees, fallen limbs, because they build nests in the trees rather than hollows, so they often are more likely to be shaken out. And especially in spring when people start doing pruning and stuff, all the nests come down with the branches. Brush-tailed possums, there's two sorts, the bobuck and the common brush-tail up here. We don't see many of the bobucks anymore. We used to see a lot more over Trenton Way, as I mentioned. Most of the car accidents, we get these. But occasional cat attack, like the one this morning. What are the main ones that come in for you? What are the main reasons they come in for you? Possums, brushies.
We're going for cars and cat attacks.
Oh, yeah. Finding little orphans. Sugar gliders we get around here, cats usually. In fact, I think every time it's been a cat that's brought one of these guys in. Feather-tailed gliders usually come in people's firewood, and cats again bring them in thinking they're mice probably, and they leave them on the doorstep as a little gift for their people. That's a full-grown adult, that one, if you haven't seen those before. They're about the size of a mouse. And we've... Yeah, that's a sub-adult, but it's almost full size. Echidnas, really busy at the moment with Echidnas. Lots of activity, particularly on the side of the road at the moment, because they're all forming trains. The males will form up to 15 in a row behind the females and trek through the forest. If you're lucky to see one of those in some areas. But it gets them into trouble because they're crossing the landscape quite a lot. Bats, we get lots of different. The next talk's on bats, isn't it? So I recommend going to that because it's fascinating. There's a whole range of them in this area.
Is it only in the first mile of human
that gets lucky? No. She'll basically allow as many males as she thinks are worthwhile to mate her. And then the males kind of fight amongst each other for access as well. But it's not exclusive in any sense. No, I don't think it works that way with these guys. We occasionally get, most of these bats are like mouse size. The chocolate waddle's about this big, the biggest one I think we get here. But this is a red flying fox. You don't see them very often. They're not like the big grey-headed ones that flock in Melbourne. These are solitary, tend to be solitary. And you find them occasionally. They're a bit smaller than the grey-headed. Water rats. These are not like the rats you get in your house, which are usually black rats or bush rats at best. These ones have been around about 15,000 years. Came over on the land bridge. And they've got webbed feet, and they basically live like otters, really, I suppose. So they're nearest eating yabbies and other... animals in water. Pretty much any water body you'd find them. There's a lot down at Dalesford Lake. There's one that hangs around Lake House, which they don't want to stay very often. But they get little scraps from them occasionally. Jubilee Lake, we found them. And most dams that have a bit of protection. You can usually find them because there's a little dinner plate they create. It's like a flat rock or something, or flat surface. And there'll be lots of crustacean shells and things they've been digging up out of the mud.
What sort of
dams
are
either one. Really, anything that's got living matter in it. So if there's yabbies in the dam or fish, some of the smaller fish, they'll habitat in those dams. They like to have reeds or something that protects the bank. Yeah, usually overhanging reeds, not so much. They need to have access to, because they burrow, they need to have access to the mud along the bank. So I don't know how they're coping with this rain with all the water levels coming up. But you've got a sort of muddy bank with overhanging plants. That's the best for them. Yeah. This is Fastigar. There was a female, this one. She's about this sort of size in the body, and with the tail about that sort of size. They live for about probably only 2 years, and if they're lucky, maybe three. But males die off in the first mating season, just from stress. So they're very quick life cycle. This is a magpie that's been caught on flypaper. Magpies often come into care. They get into all sorts of strife, of course, hanging around people's houses. Often they come in with, like this guy was raised on raw mincemeat, people try and raise them, and it's not a full diet for them, so they end up with a kind of rickets. They get deformed feet. So we really try and carry people not to feed those birds unless they really give them a proper diet. And even then, it should only be supplementary. This is one I was reading to. Again, occasionally other birds, not many big numbers. Corellas, I suppose, are the next big number, but that's a little peewit or a mudpie, a magpie lark. Rosella, they're a big one. We get nests of these falling out all the time. They're hilarious birds. They're the most ungrateful guests, though, because they love you while you're feeding them, and then they get to a certain age and they just want to eat you. They bite you and they scream at you, and they're very unfriendly. Wattle birds, lots of chicks, ducks. Oh, ducks are a big one, increasingly so, actually. I think this year will be a good year for ducks. We'll get lots of little ones in, probably. Long-billed gorillas, some of them do breed around here, so we do get these guys coming in. Soft crested cockatoos, this guy was shot. We get quite a few of these guys shot, but mainly cars, in on the road. This is Tawny Frogmouth, usually come in as chicks, but occasionally they also get hit by cars. They chase them off in front of the car headlights. This is an owl falling asleep on top of the door. This guy was hit by a car, he had a damaged eye, so we had to fly him with all our aviaries were full, so we were flying him in the house. So he did with us for a while. It was challenging, but quite delightful most of the time. A little bit of clean up we can do. Especially when we used to feed him, because we have to feed them live, not live prey, full body prey, because they need all the guts and the internal organs. So we had to feed them rats. We got supplied by someone who, the rats were a bit large for him, and he would pick up the rat from his feeding station and fly across the room with it. And these ones were too large, so he'd be flying lower and lower, and the cats would be following around on the ground. That's the damage that he came in with. He actually was released after 6 months, and we can still hear him around the house, actually. West Coast Eagle, often the young ones get into strife there. This real highly specialised animal, so if they get into trouble, like strange winds and wind changes, those kind of things, that can put a lot of stress on their wings, and they often dislocate or break shoulders from wind shears that occur around the place. And then they just tumble out of the sky. Because these guys, when they do mating flight, they do this kind of thing when they're mating. So they need to have very strong. This guy, he was, I think it's a she now. She's still with us. She would have been a chick last spring. So this photo was done probably 6 months old. Hello? Oops. This is a white-faced heron. We get night herons. A lot of these kind of birds, which are basically fish and crustacean eaters, they get into trouble on people's dams, usually with trees falling around the edge of dams. And they come in as chicks, one of the last ones we've had. This is our emu. Likes to see what goes on. She's out and about at the moment. But she was brought to us from too far north, so we couldn't release her locally. She's really a New South Wales race, so we have to keep her with us, really. And we can't take her back over there to New South Wales because of quarantine issues, and we can't let her go in northern Victoria because the farmers are all shooting them at the moment. Because they do damage fences. This is Macbeth, our goat. He was rescued from Daylesford Lake. There's a lot of feral goats around Daylesford in the forest. And they come down to Daylesford Lake in the evening. This is our feeding. We use lots of volunteers, one of the big jobs is filling our bottles, which is a whole all-day job, where they have to wash them and sterilise them and load them up with different milk formulas. We have kangaroos have four different milk formulas depending on how old they are, because it changes as they get older. And wombats have three, and then each species basically has its own milk. Which is one of the reasons I don't know whether you've got specialist milk supplies, but they don't do well on cow's milk. When you were raising yours, did you use cow's milk?
We do.
I don't know how people manage it. In the past, like we're really lucky, we've got sort of third generation wildlife carers. The generation before us were trained by the people who did all the experimenting and basically worked out how to raise these animals. The third generation are kind of, we've got all this science-based stuff that we can work from. So we're really lucky. I really take my hat off to the people who were doing it 60 years ago. Because they're using carnation milk and they have to put additives in, all this stuff. Very difficult to raise these creatures. These are just some of our routines, really. It just goes on all day. We work about 13 hours a day, and we try and have at least one volunteer a day. When I drew this picture, I thought, oh, this is funny. I'll just draw all these kangaroos, but this is pretty much at least this number that we do now. So it's not so funny anymore. It's not a caricature. This is what we get our volunteers to do. I won't go into this too much. Unless anyone's particularly interested in doing volunteer work, then I'm happy to talk to you. Because we always need people. These are some of the things outside the shelter that we need help with. Well, the building enclosure is always happening. But these are kind of one-off jobs. So even if you can't come regularly, if you would like to help, then there are things you can do. Some of these we have volunteers that are helping with. This is my mantra. It helps me get up and keep going throughout the day. When the journey's over, there'll be time enough to sleep. I think I might stop there, but these are some of the things that inspire me, really. I suppose the idea of exercising our compassion. I think wildlife care has a really good role in that. That it's often our first contact with wildlife, because you know, Australian wildlife is nighttime only, and we very rarely see it except at a distance. But when we hit something, we're immediately engaged with it, and we maybe our first opportunity to actually feel that empathy. But we were inspired when we first. We had a possum in the front of our house in St Kilda, and she'd been there for 3 years, raised three joeys. Oh, we'd been there 3 years. She'd raised at least three joeys. And then the neighbour took out their tree, which was leaning across our yard because we were on a first-story flat. And we were so worried about her and her joeys that we ended up getting involved in wildlife care, because we took her into care and we found her and had to find her a rehab site, which took us ages. And because we had to do survey work to find out whether there are any other possums in the area and whether there was room for her to go. So it really engaged us with it anyway. So we were, although we're environmental scientists, you know, so we had the science background, it was all very intellectual, but it engaged us emotionally, I think it's a really important aspect. And by being out there in the public, we kind of legitimise the empathy that people feel for wildlife, so I think it actually plays a quite an important role. And you know, an opportunity to redemption of the human spirit, something a little bit too. I did a talk for a church. I thought I'd try to put it in terms of that might sound a bit more religious, but I don't want to make it sound too heavy. But I do think that it's an opportunity for people, because a lot of the contact we have with people is so devoid of the natural world and the things around us. You know, we can't even get them to engage in climate change very well. But I'm hoping that by relating to other living things, we can actually improve people's contact. And then start to understand those sort of things around endangered species and loss of habitat. So they begin to think and they begin to make those sort of connections that we need them to make to think this stuff through. And Thoreau's thinking man is, when the law is wrong, the place for a thinking man is in prison. So that's just a way of saying that when you see that something's not right, it's really important to stand up for it, because otherwise we just allow it to happen, and it just continues to happen. These are our challenges. I won't go into those, so you don't need to hear any negative stuff, but it's really about our finances, the time that it takes for this kind of stuff, the kind of emotional journey that we go on. But we do have plans, so we're hoping to put a paramedic unit together, which means that we can actually service the whole region here with more equipment and skills, so we can support other shelters to do what we do. That's a sign of hope. Yeah. More signs of hope. There we go. That's it. Thanks very much.